Dove Creek, a novel read by the author Paula Coomer and brought to you by KRFP in Moscow, Idaho.
Mystery, mystery, behind the veil, surprise me. Confound me. Surround me.
This is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either products of the author's imagination or used in a fictional way. Any resemblance to actual locales or persons, living or dead, is entirely coincidental.
Patricia has dates with a hospital maintenance man and a writer who attempted suicide. She contemplates the continuing purpose of her existence while she finishes building her fire. Dove Creek, Epilogue. Passionate existence is an act of resistance. From a flyer on a bulletin board in Moscow, Idaho. May 4th, 2008, Clarkston, Washington. It's been raining for days. It's not quite 2 weeks since Elizabeth's birthday. Elizabeth is my granddaughter. I have two now, both girls, both with the same chubby legs and faraway gaze as their grandmother. Both have blue eyes, both curly blondes. Both will probably grow up to become teenagers who spend half their days futzing with their hair just like I did until they decide to face the world as they came into it. Elizabeth is younger than her sister Molly by 2 years. This birthday was her first, so we threw a party. Their cousin Theo pitched a baseball that landed in the cake. Elizabeth's laugh was so full of joy and purity, I thought my heart would break from the crystal clear beauty of the sound. So our family seems to have finally calmed a bit. Mark's latest marriage didn't take. He's had two since the divorce, but his heart attack has left him at peace with himself. He was alone at a family gathering for the first time, balder, trimmer, no gum-snapping third wife on his arm in those stupid plaid golfing culottes she wore. He took Brett and Zach bowling before the party, squeezed into the only open lane during the annual senior citizens tournament down the street at Lancelot Lanes. Two league members had passed on since registration. The bowling alley management asked first out of respect for its dead members, but of course the league said Mark and the two boys should come on and play. They ended up eating tournament cake, and so, cake twice that day. The calories wouldn't hurt any of them as far as I'm concerned. All three are too thin. But then Mark needs to be. His heart attack nearly killed him. Zach is the most muscular. He's joined the fire department and volunteers as an EMT. He lives with a group of housemates from his church and is contemplating Bible college, none of which he gets from me. I would never even step inside a church, but I found a good AA meeting at the Episcopal here in Lewiston. I never imagined myself in such a place, for such a reason. But it did get to the point where I had to face it. I was a drinker. Not an alcoholic, yet maybe, by the pure definitions of dependency and addiction, but my Cherokee and Scottish genes make me too susceptible for comfort. And I go there with my very own housemate and knight, Evan. Evan arrived in the nick of time, at the point I gave up on finding someone with whom to share my soul and my home, and was making plans to move to San Diego to start a writing institute with Duane Harrington. He and Luca would share with me their house overlooking the sea. We had applied for a grant. I wondered for a while if I were lesbian, except I'm not charmed by women, although on a scouting trip to Southern California, by way of experiment, I did meet and kiss another woman. All cats are gray after dark, so they say, but I didn't think much of the experience and didn't get hooked. Not to mention how drunk I was. It was Evan who finally kindly pointed out that I'm not much fun to be around when I drink, and he and I were spending nights in our neighborhood pub as a form of entertainment. Alcohol is a magnifying glass for all quirks, I finally ascertained, the highlight being me accusing him of wanting to take a botany class to scout for indiscriminate sex partners. Funny that realization about myself didn't come about until I told Evan I was going to have to leave him because of the amount he was drinking. Wise and sweet man that he is, he took my hand and asked if I would pursue counseling in AA with him before we broke things off, just to settle his mind about his part in encouraging my bad habits. Of course, you know, the moment I had to stand before that crowd and say, "My name is Patricia, and I think I might be an alcoholic," all my little red demons popped their little red demon heads out and started screaming, "No, no, we're not one. We're not one of those." But I already knew I was. The single slip of an angel on my shoulder whispered a gentle reminder of the Friday nights I drove back to Idaho over Rattlesnake Grade from handing over Brett and Zach to Mark at the Dairy Queen and Enterprise with a six-pack between my knees of the world's best local brew made right there in Wallowa County, and the night or two a triplet of pints at Lear's preceded that six-pack. Nights I had to pull off along the roadside, big black terror in the bush or no, to sleep it off. I kept my sleeping bag, a ski jacket, and a pillow in the trunk for just that reason. As I have done previously when faced with emotional ghosts, tonight after Evan went to bed, I pulled the crate of old journals off the shelf, the first time since my solo camping trip on the Lost Ene, to try and make sense of what I had been feeling in the weeks since Elizabeth's party, when Mark and Evan finally shook hands. A moment quivery but monumental for us all. 3:06 a.m., Pullman, Washington, June 12, 2003. I'm on the kitchen floor between the refrigerator and cabinets on an air mattress 8 inches thick, indigo blue, velvet top. I pray there are no mice. It is 3 a.m., 8 hours after Brett's wedding. I am sobbing as silently as possible into my sleeping bag, probably getting salt stains on my new Ralph Lauren pillows. Bagel, a dachshund belonging to my house guests, comes ticking in, curls next to my heart. Disarmed by his compassion, I pull myself into a bean shape, a fetus. The animal's warm, mink-soft body should console me. Instead, it makes me cry even harder. I feel like my sternum and ribs are going to split. I knew this house was too tiny for guests, but I did not trust myself to be alone this weekend. There are 3 rooms, each barely 10 foot square, room enough for a couch and the computer in one, my bed in the other. Everything else is sold or in boxes on the porch. I took this place because it is quaint and white, original plaster, 6-inch window sills, and porcelain doorknobs. My good friend Sally, with whom I worked on the Coeur d'Alene reservation, and her husband Amos are staying the night, along with their son Austin and the angelic Bagel. After breakfast, Sally will send Amos and Austin home. She will stay on for as long as it takes. We've spent the weekend muted, polite, surrounded by my family and new in-laws and strangers and by ex-in-laws and an ex-husband and a failed history. Brett leaves today with his beloved Sarah, his longtime girlfriend and roommate, for their honeymoon on Maui, and my heart is balking like a mule. I feel as if I'm trying to birth him through my veins. 10:17 a.m., June 18, Monday. I've been awake for 72 hours. Bagel won't leave my lap. Sally spent yesterday forcing me to brainstorm while she recorded it in a large spiral-bound sketchbook. She insisted I make a list of my unrequited desires and drew pictures to represent each of them so that I could visualize what I might want to do next with my life. She insisted a degree from UC Berkeley was too crazy and definitely not a reward for having stayed the course. Topping my list of material things I'd always wanted but never gotten was a sky blue Super Beetle convertible. For some reason, Sally jumped on that one. I had in mind picking up a copy of the Nickel ads. Now she's got her shoes on, telling me to get ready for a road trip. No point in fooling with classics, she says. You'd be smarter to go for a new one. Of course, I know what she doesn't, that weddings are expensive, even if you are only the mother of the groom, and I'm in debt to my collarbone. No way I can buy enough gas to get to Spokane and back, let alone afford a new car. and I spent my last dollars on Chinese takeout last night. Nonetheless, Sally waves her sketch of a perfect Beetle convertible with me in it, smiling and waving, ragtop a flattened accordion, wind a stack of parallel wavy lines, my hair blowing tendrils, then closes the sketchbook and tucks it in her bag. It does feel right, I have to admit, and we both seem to know without saying it, before the day's end, I'll be driving a new Beetle convertible. The ad for new Volkswagens rises in my head. Drivers wanted. I named her Thelma, as in the film Thelma and Louise, but with a different ending, as I'm quick to point out. Thelma is not my first convertible. At 18, I married Jeff, the guitar-picking, ex-heroin-addicted Jesus freak, and a year later, we bought a 69 Cougar RX-7. That convertible took muscle to fold back the top and lock the hatch, and I remember what it felt like being 19 and looking good in that thing. And it was only a tiny bit scary when the gas pedal stuck and we shed rubber and burned brake pads on Main Street, the smell like black strap molasses. We traded the Cougar shortly after for a 69 Barracuda Fastback Jeff then sold for no reason. Daddy gave us a 64 Falcon station wagon because we didn't have anything to drive, the same one doled to me as punishment in high school after Jeff totaled my first car. Morbidly uncool, but, as Daddy said, everything worked. Daddy projected a bit of car paranoia onto my high school days. He refused even to let me think about buying the MG Midget convertible I wanted, or the Super Beetle. No doubt recalling his own love of the wind and his curly red hair and the pace at which he'd fishtailed along Adair County dirt roads, even though I didn't get my first speeding ticket until I was 40, I believe he suspected such motivations considering the company I kept. Mick, 72 Cuda, Damon, 71 Charger, Martine from Holland, 69 MG Midget, Rob, 65 Mustang, Lenny, 71 Roadrunner. Boys who spent their after-school paychecks on headers and chromed Krager rims and glass packs and spoilers and hood scoops. These were jacked street rods, and more than once those boys were busted for drag racing. They only let me hang out because they coveted my weed-green 71 Plymouth Satellite, 320 and straight factory save the 8-track cassette player Daddy installed for my 16th birthday. Right after we became engaged, Jeff and I drove to Adair County to meet Grandpa Hattie and Grandpa Darnell and to view the family homestead. 15 miles of dirt lane to the slate-bottom creek called Petty's Fork. Cabin Branch Holler was a mile's drive down the creek bed. We dodged drop-offs under arched black oak and sugar trees with the satellite windows down, heads hanging out the windows looking for water moccasins. On the return trip, the same inattention earned us a head-on collision, rounding a blind curve just as we nosed up from the creek bed with a spindly man in an old flatbed. "Afternoon, Clyde," the old codger said to the state trooper who came dusting up in his 1950s-era cruiser. The insurance company declared the satellite a total loss. A Concord purple bruise emerged in the days that followed, covering my entire right arm, took weeks to disappear. Daddy kept the satellite parked in the lower bays of our old two-story garage as a reminder to do what I was told, which meant not letting boys behind the wheel of my car. My further punishment was to drive the Falcon station wagon, the same one Jeff and I would drive to Arizona in the spine of winter, 1977. The morning is wide, the sky a distant, tight blue arc. "What?" Sally asks. "Why do you feel so bad? Brett and Sarah are happy. You've done your job. We've spent too much of our lives feeling bad. It's time for passion." What has me feeling so bad? I barely know where to start, but Sally urges me on with the list of Brettisms. He learned to say hot coffee at 18 months, but said it hot cocky. Once jumped up and yelled, "Hot cocky," when the bathwater was too hot. His first sentence at 18 months was, "Woo, you hassho," aimed at our friend Lou, the fire chief, who was harassing Brett through the rolled-down car window. He tripped carrying an empty popcorn bowl with a chipped rim, 2 years old, 2 stitches in the chin. He snored. At 4, he snored like a drunk, tonsils the size of plums. Got discovered by a photographer while waiting in the new day surgery wing for his tonsillectomy. He became the face and voice for a hospital in Salem, Oregon. Radio, TV, brochures, newspaper. He was paid $200. We used it to pay travel costs for Mark's interview in LeGrand. He made art in preschool. His silhouette and two baby hands cut from black construction paper and glued to white. He played soccer and t-ball. I watched practices and games sitting on mown grass and wood bleachers smelling summer. He dirtied new shin guards, scared me with full bloody lunges to stop speed of light balls, pounded his mitt with fisted boy fingers. He tried sex at 6 with my best friend's daughter. He was 12 when he told me this. Where did he learn sex at 6? From HBO, he said. He wore his first tuxedo at 6, ring bearer at my brother Delbert's wedding. He performed his role perfectly, unlike I did as a flower girl. He started playing saxophone in 6th grade. For $40 a month, you could rent a saxophone. For 40 more, you could buy private lessons. An agile, white-haired woman led you across dusted hardwood floors to her husband's studio, a converted bedroom with a piano and 2 chairs in front of a black metal music stand. The ruddy-cheeked saxophone teacher sat in one chair, pointed Brent to the other. I wrote a check and handed it to the wife, waited in my Civic until the lesson was over. After a few months, Brett got a job delivering papers, up at 5 a.m. to rubber band the daily news, plastic them if it rained. I never got up to help. He used the money to buy a saxophone, saving me the cost of the rental. He got his first real job washing windows at 16 for Sears. He stayed 5 years, was a supervisor by 20. He got kicked out of Mark's house a month before high school graduation, homeless, on the streets, for getting drunk at a frat party. Friends took him in. I was so broke I couldn't get to him. This was hard, Mom, he said, when I arrived for the graduation ceremony Mark did not attend. Brett packed his 92 Buick Skylark and came to live with me. He built his first computer at 19. Where did he learn this? At 23, he was still at his second job as a data librarian, a commitment that garnered him free college tuition. He had one girlfriend. He knew her less than a month before deciding to marry her. He knelt on one knee in a restaurant where he proposed. He sang to her at the reception. Frank Sinatra in his tuxedo and shiny black patent leather shoes sang to her into a microphone, amplified and recorded for all of history, 200 guests, and a dance floor still as crystal, unforgettable. In further response to Sally's question, I should have said I was embarrassed. I wanted to make for my sons a cottage on a seascape. We would have watched sunset melting silver water into the ocean, eaten pomegranates and tangerines for breakfast. We should have grown flowers plenty enough to sell, walked with our toes in the water and raced to keep it from our rolled pant legs. We should have driven with the top down on summer Saturdays to eat ice cream on the main square watching tourists. We should have read books and told stories and filled daily walks with colorful conversations, for this is what felt possible when they were small. I worry I modeled for them prisons from which I was constantly escaping, that one day it will be they who are saying, "Give me air, give me air, let me breathe." The Volkswagen dealer in Spokane has 3 new Beetles. No sky blue, but tangerine, weed green, and a very pale yellow called mellow yellow. I've never favored owning a yellow car, but I certainly am not up for tangerine or another weed green. Plus, as I recently read in some magazine, yellow is the color of the third chakra, or the solar plexus, associated with power, prosperity, and will. If the solar plexus is blocked, we may feel helpless. I'm hoping a yellow car is a symbol of my reclaiming my own power. The payment is 25% of my take-home pay, but I cannot see dollars on the line of a checkbook, only that the top lifts away with the push of a button. And then the test drive, Sally in the back, Mike the car salesman in the passenger seat, driving the wooded neighborhood south and east of the Spokane Valley, stillness, no distance between heart and sky, infusion of the real. Maybe it is the organicity of leather seats. Maybe the depths of NPR and classical music coming from a sound system called Monsoon. Either way, the dotted line stretches like a new horizon. And I cannot tell Sally what I cannot begin to admit, even to myself, that Mark wore the death mask at Brett's wedding.
You've been listening to Paula Coomer reading from her novel, Dove Creek.
All the oxen free, come out from behind the tree. You and I were meant to be.
In the novel's epilogue, it is 7 years later. Patricia has met Evan, to whom she is engaged. She remembers Brett's wedding, at which Mark looked ill and wan, as if he were wearing the death mask. August 3rd, 2003, Lewiston, Idaho. Brett and I put the top down on Thelma and go for Thai food in Lewiston, a favorite restaurant from the old days. I don't know what we order, some wondrous rendition of vegetables and meat and spice. He is turning 23 and feels old. I tell him 25 will feel the most significant. Living a quarter century is sobering. He's working on his term paper for a summer philosophy course, still trying to finish his degree, and talks about time as a human construct and how phony, and before long, neither of us feels old at all. His cell phone rings. He pulls it out of his pocket long enough to check the caller ID. Mark's sister. Eh, he says, I'll get it later. Brett is not aware of this, but he exudes confidence and relevance. At 6'2 and 260 or 270, he is imposing, the weight merely a guess because I've never considered him in the context of appearance, only of his self, the self I know least and best, the self of his mind and heart and idiosyncrasies. Out in the parking lot, we share a cigarette. I tell him he needs to listen to his message from Mark's sister. He does. She sounds chipper, he says, so there must not be a problem. When's the last time she called you? I ask. He looks at me. 2 years ago, before the family reunion. He drops his head, pulls the phone from his pocket in a motion I love, purposeful, confident. He is the eye of a tornado keeping everybody calm, the powerball of restoring order, secure without hesitance. Brett knows he is capable of bearing responsibility and accepts it. He knows it because I put him in hard situations that made him learn to wade his way through crap. What I created is what I see. His body falls. As he stands in the parking lot of the Thai Taste in Lewiston, Idaho, talking on his cell phone to Mark's sister, my powerful son loses 2 inches in height. He bows his head toward his chest. He focuses into the invisible wave carrying the message of his father's imminent death. Mark has 5 coronary arteries 90% blocked. He's had an emergency bypass. He's in ICU. He's signed a do not resuscitate order. In all the hours of conversations we had as a married couple about age and death and final wishes and funerals, neither of us expected that as early as 2005 the rest of us might be contemplating a future after Mark's death. I do not want my sons to lose their father this early. I do not want Mark to die. I think signing the DNR is a knee-jerk reaction, that he's young and limiting his chances, and say as much. But Brett says he and Mark and Zach have discussed it. Mark doesn't want to risk landing in a vegetative state. I've known him long enough to know this might be the case. He's a Westerner, a cowboy, a bona fide Rush Limbaugh conservative who thinks we shouldn't spend the money to keep anyone alive. And I'm familiar enough with the fallout from his most recent divorce to know he's not prepared for his own long-term care. He'd be reliant on Medicaid and federal disability benefits, just like the people he oversees in his job as a nursing home administrator. but he's known about his familial hypercholesterolemia since early in our marriage. I treated him myself with wheat germ and yogurt and oat bran and niacin. He had balloon angioplasty. But he dipped Copenhagen in Huff box wine, not a day going by without bacon and red meat. I did not want Mark to die, but I did hope the surgery might change him. I imagined the coagulated blood in his coronary arteries as blackened muck that when scraped out would loose his soul and left up his intellect. I wanted his heart to embrace the magic, the miracle that is free existence, for him to stop shouting at traffic lights, for him to be the non-critical, non-bigoted, spirited man I saw trapped in his working man attitude. I thought he might rise from his hospital bed and remember how badly he wanted me. So I sent a card. 3 weeks later, called him. "Life's a bitch, and then you die," he said. What could I conclude but that no amount of blood or oxygen to the heart and brain will enliven some people? "What do you think of Zach?" I asked. "Working construction? Driving fire crews?" He called. "He's up by Elk City. Thought he'd be out in 2 weeks. I think it's good for him. What do you think?" Our youngest being a man. "Well, he always did like being important," Mark said. There it was again, the insufferable difference between us. In my eyes, Zach was a young adult human with guts enough to take his damage and turn it into the strength to pursue a dream. At the age of 21, to put himself in danger for the sake of trying to pay off his debt, embracing new skills and doing it well, hanging sheetrock and siding and roofing shingles, laying hardwood floors, tiling bathrooms, a fireplace. What heart, I wanted Mark to say. And I wished to tell him about Anna, about the child of ours with so much heart she loves even though she never lived. The child of his he refused the grace of birth. I'd been seeing a psychologist, still trying to figure how to move on from it all. In the old high school building that houses Dr. Smith's offices is the early childhood education program. On a day in June, roughly 15 years after Anna should have been born, a woman stepped into the hallway and grabbed my arm, leading me to a rack of catalogs describing their services, faded blue with the face of a baby on the cover. They were looking to hire a program director. I was briefly intrigued. Made an appointment to come talk with her, but before I got up the stairs, changed my mind. I forgot the entire scene, had my visit with Dr. Smith, drove to the grocery to buy a dozen white roses for my friend Laura, who had invited me to dinner. We laughed when I handed her roses and she the gift she brought me from a recent trip to Europe, a bottle of rose liqueur. It wasn't until she picked up the bouquet to relieve them of their cellophane that I saw it, the white, oval label, naming the variety of rose, Anna. December 25th, 2003, Moscow, Idaho. Someone had the bright idea the four of us should gather for Christmas. I don't know what propagated the wish, but we all concurred. It's time. We will gather at Zach's apartment. Mark and I will share the cost of dinner. I will spend more money on gifts than I have since the divorce, most significantly buying the poker table and chip set in a chrome suitcase Zach wants. Mark buys me Larry McMurtry's Loop Group. I give him a used bookstore copy of Ivan Doig's This House of Sky. Zach and I argue about a tree. He doesn't want it. I want to bring the family ornaments. I listen to his arguments, his wish not to be reminded of old Duff, pointing out that this history made him brave enough to drive a school bus, star in commercials and theater, an indie film. I point out that any kink in the road and he would not be earning scholarships, would not be embracing the stunning, dark-haired Catherine. But in the end, Zach wins. The dinner table between us will be enough of an emblem. I arrive early Christmas morning to bake turkey and dressing in my traditional way, the way Mom taught me, the way Grandma Kelty taught her. At 8 a.m., Mark comes to the kitchen and asks, "Who the hell is making all the racket?" He grins, a familial embrace. I offer him coffee. He wears jeans, a black t-shirt, a black shirt over the top. I aim not to overwhelm, but I want to sit and say, "How are you? What do you think about all of us now? But Mark despises revealing chatter, a consequence of his old philosophy that what is past is past, what is painful is best left unspoken. I feel it in his hug. I see it in the face he is putting forward. There will be no talk of yesterdays. There will be only today. It is hard on me. I want to decipher what got us here. I want to know. Instead, I pour coffee, offer cream, listen to the backdrop as he pulls Zach legs first from bed and into consciousness. They are hungover. Likely Brett, too, although he slept at his in-laws in bed with his wife, as he should. Mark and Zach wrestle, spout vulgarities. There are crashes and threats, and I bolster myself, trying to squelch my alarm, but it is impossible. Knock it off, I say, or you're grounded. They stumble to the kitchen. We scrounge breakfast. I cement myself into the moment, make myself remember. This is not our 24th Christmas breakfast, but a tag, an anomaly. The day clocks by just fine. Mark breathes easily as he reads me portions of a novel he's written. It's a cop story. I vow to edit it for him, to help him get it published. We drink. We joke. The four of us play poker into the night. I long for Mark to spirit me to a corner and slip a tongue between my lips, but he doesn't. By 3 a.m. we have consumed 2 bottles of wine, a case of beer, a pint of whiskey. We line the poker table like 4 emotional Frankensteins, maniacal in our jokes, our laughter. I try to tell the story about the day Mark insisted we buy a new vacuum when I thought the old Kirby was just fine. The 3 of them shush me. In the end, Mark wins all and keeps it. It is 4 a.m. when we blanket ourselves into corners for sleep. I am curled on the sofa, trail off, dream of moving back to the beginning, back to Lewiston, where a wide valley opens to 2 great rivers, the Clearwater and the Snake, where I lived when I came to work for the Nez Perce, driving back and forth to Eatonville because I couldn't find the creative energy I craved. How silly I didn't notice that exact creative energy inside of me. May 4th, 2008, Clarkston, Washington. I met Evan after I made a Saturday sojourn to a local antiques mall called The Hangar. It's a barbarous old aircraft hangar along the Clarkston side of the Snake River, holographs of the same tufted hills as flank Lewiston for backdrop, H2O molecules exchanging ions with the atmosphere, hopefully the antidote to all the junk the Potlatch Mill spews into our air. Perhaps an acre of junk and treasures, chic and shabby, period clothing, formica-topped chrome tables, knick-knacks, old fishing gear and hunting knives, railroad memorabilia, depression glass, carnival ware, crocs, primitives, oak tables and chests, hard-faced relatives and daguerreotypes, sepia cherubs, blue boy portraits, fainting couches, etched crystal wine glasses, paperbacks, and old school books. Buried in a stack of gross 1950s-era department store prints was a pair of embroidered bluebirds in yellow frames. I did some like them as a teenager, formed them around cardboard, tacked them to a barnwood frame. I continued browsing, but bluebirds were stuck in my brain. When I saw a pale-haired man wearing eyeglasses thumbing through the stack of prints, my heart stopped. I suddenly remembered an old Shirley Temple film in which she sees a finch change from gray to blue. I'd recently rewatched that film and thought, of course, it was the bluebird of happiness filmmakers first thought to colorize, the making blue of that bluebird being a craft phenomenon of the day. How hard I pretended they were not mine. But that man kept hovering, and I was beginning to worry he was going to buy them and to feel inexplicably angry. I did not want those things in somebody else's hands, but I also did not want to go back to the beginning. I did not want to return to being the person I was in my childhood. When the man finally moved away from the stack of prints, I rushed to retrieve the embroidery. There was no question about it. Exact over and under and satin stitches, lazy daisy, French knots. One bird flew holding pink snapdragons in his beak, the other perched on a branch clutching daisies like the eagle clutching wheat on a dollar. I was 15 when I started doing thread work, moving from basic letter samplers to full scenes made exclusively of counted cross-stitch on a blank canvas, the most ambitious of which I gave to Mark's parents for Christmas the year before the separation. A lake view from a front porch, a barrel holding a geranium, curtained window slightly opened, a rocking chair with a patchwork quilt draped across its arm, maidenhair ferns hanging from the overhangs in baskets, framed mahogany 18 by 24 inches, every warp and weave of 12-count canvas covered in two passes of the needle, a colored X, a solid painting of thread. I knew the bluebirds were mine because there was an error, a tiny half-inch row of stitches I left unstitched, meant to fix but never did, chastise myself over the laziness that kept me from threading those six stitches. But I can't remember. Did I throw the bluebirds into the footlocker in 1978, take them back to New Albany to spend the summer, then carrying them with me to Oregon? Did I sell them when I purged myself of my belongings at a barter market in Santa, Idaho, after Zach moved out to start college? Or leave them in Phoenix in a storage unit for which Jeff never paid the bill? Did they travel 1,200 miles in 27 years, or 150 miles in 14 years? I spilled my tale to the clerk, an older Latina I'd seen working there before, who was talking to Evan, whom she introduced as owning another antique store in town. "How did you get these?" I begged. "Who runs that booth?" Evan told a story about discovering his own grandmother's china at an auction 20 years and 1,500 miles from San Francisco, where they were sold at her estate sale. He called his sisters, who confirmed the woman had them embossed on the back in gold with the letters A.C., for Alma Cochran. The three of us walked to the bin the bluebirds came from to check for further clues, while the clerk and Evan exchanged stories of other antiques market miracles. Booth owners buy things from estate sales and rummage and garage sales, they said. People happen into or feel inexplicably drawn to an auction or antique store where something of their families waits for them. There's always a distinguishing mark. "Happens all the time," the clerk said. "I call it junk store milagro. God does make miracles, you know." "But really, how does something like this happen?" I asked. "Fate," she said, charging me $22 instead of the $25 on the tag for my own handiwork. I called Daddy. He said I left the row of stitches undone as a way to mark them, so I would recognize them. He told about a member of our old church, First Assembly of God in New Albany, calling to say he was driving through Arizona, stopped up to pick up a hitchhiker, and it was my long-haired, round-shouldered first husband, Jeff. I sat on my couch, staring at the colorful thread renderings. How long since I'd touched these two? What daughter's bedroom wall held the nail that held them? I pried them from their hot pink frames, wondering what happened to the barnwood ones. Both pieces in perfect condition, housed behind glass. But I recognized the way the fabric was stretched over rectangular pieces of cardboard, recognized the distinct way I fold and miter corners, the way I misplaced the masking tape, now slightly brittle, to hold the edges. It felt as if no time had passed, as if I were 16 and proud of my stitchery. I was good at it. How many hours did I spend as a girl uncarding and threading a needle? Evan got my phone number off my check and called me that night. He thought I had a certain dignity, a rare beauty, and that it was significant we met the way we did. I told him I didn't want to make too much of it. I was tired of magic and voodoo and signs and prophecies. I only wanted what was solid, real as the earth. I told him about a theory I recently read indicating the entire universe was waiting for the human race to achieve enlightenment, that all beings in all other worlds and dimensions had done so. We were the last to arrive. I didn't make a date with Evan that night, but he was persistent. I finally decided to go out with him when he told me about how long he'd stayed in his marriage, just for the sake of commitment, admittedly subjugating his disappointment and anesthetizing himself with work, travel, movies, books, sports, social commitments, whatever distraction he could create for himself and his wife, because he didn't want to risk hurting her just because he'd made a mistake. He waited until she made the decision for him by moving back to Birmingham to care for a dying family member. In my classes at the university, I often teach the hero's journey, the quest for an imagined prize leading to the unimagined discovery of self, home, and love. I made peace with the bluebirds by deciding they were on a road of their own. But I also know it was my road, my decisions, that brought me back around to them, and I have Moose and his story of the seven directions to thank for that. In the film I watched the weekend of Elizabeth's party, the red violin, an historic violin, followed a long journey over hundreds of years to arrive in the hands and hearts of the descendants of its maker. Months later, hanging them in their new mats and frames in the guest room where my granddaughters sleep when they visit, in the two-story Victorian Evan and I share together, I decided I arrived at the Bluebirds right on schedule to mark my rite of passage into the life I so long sought, my journey wrought a teenage rebellion, finally, thankfully, done. But I should tell about the honeymooners' return from Maui. We were at Sarah's parents' house. Hugs and laughter and two people, beautiful, tanned, young, and in love. Brett in a luau shirt, Sarah in a tropical print dress. "You look different, Mom," Brett said. "I look different," I said. "You're the one with the wedding band." Inwardly, I demurred, hands in pockets, the VW emblem on the new key pulsing against my thigh. "Wait a minute," Brett said, pulling my hand free, snatching my keys, pointing to the new black electronic rectangle at my face. "This isn't the key to your car." He ran outside. The entire family ran outside. "Holy cow," he said. "Holy cow, Mom." Brett climbed behind the wheel, adjusted the seat, tried the air conditioning, the stereo, adjusted the side mirrors with their joysticks. Finally, he looked up, grinning, pulled the roof latch, pushed the electronic lever, the top accordion back on itself gracefully. He approved the Monsoon sound system with its 10 speakers, praised the whisper of the 1.8-liter turbo, sucked in his breath at 150 horsepower in a Beetle. "Heated," I said. "The seats are heated." "I see that," he said. "How much?" "Not telling," I said. Who can explain it? Smiles arising from a cute little car. Strangers stop me in parking lots. "That is one happy car," they insisted. Literary friends swore she was a sentient being. Could be it was the turbo engine churning that extra air into horsepower, power that translated into energy. Maybe it was simply that the world became sensual driving topless, privy to sounds, smells, tastes of wind. Maybe my DNA remembered an earlier world in which I lived open to the elements. And maybe it was only that Brett and Zach had found good, solid places in the world, and I was happy for it. Any way you considered it, everyone agreed. Thelma radiated. "I don't get what's the big deal," someone's faint whisper. "She never does anything for herself," said the mother of the bride, voice low. "But I heard her. Oh, how I heard her." What she did not discern was that a black coal nugget of guilt was stuck tight in my throat from knowing it was all for me. Every rock and scrape I had the nerve to create, life and the world's benevolence intervened to carry my family and I safely over. I think it was William Blake who said, "The road of excess leads to the palace of wisdom." at long last, to know at least this one tiny thing.
You've been listening to Paula Coomer, reading from her novel, Dove Creek. Dove Creek was produced by Nancy Casey and Paula Coomer with help from KRFP, a listener-supported non-commercial radio station at 92.5 FM in Moscow, Idaho. You can find KRFP on the web at krfp.org, where you can click on Dove Creek to learn more about this broadcast, sign up for a podcast, or send an email. There you can also contact Bill Finch, who wrote and performs our theme song.